Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of May the 18th, 2020. Get the right day. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. Now, if you're looking at our title card here, you know, the main title slide, you're going to notice this is a little different. And it's different for a simple reason. We're going to talk about one thing this week, not multiples. And that's kind of bad because I actually had all the other stuff set up. And it's still on the website, so you can go read about it there. But at the end of the day on Friday, after I had everything ready to go, and even have the slides ready, the Small Business Administration published the PPP loan forgiveness application. And given that all the questions we have been getting have been on this forgiveness calculation, how it's going to work, I've decided that the thing that makes the most sense to do this week is to concentrate on this application. Now, that said, there is one development last week I want to remind you of. If you haven't already heard, during the week they added a new question to the Frequently Asked Questions page where they kind of just backed off that whole theory that you had to essentially worry about proving the need for the loan, that you could be pulled for audit or review if you had a loan of less than $2 million. They told us late in the week that essentially, if you get a $2 million or less loan, that you will be presumed to have had, you know, adequate reason for asking for loan. The loan was necessary for your business. So that doesn't say they wouldn't examine you for other reasons. They very well might. In fact, they kind of imply that, I think, mainly to cover themselves in this, that, we still mean that, but we're going to go ahead and assume that you had adequate reason. You're a small business. You don't have access to capital like a larger company would. So, yeah, we're going to go ahead and say that's okay. That is significant. Unfortunately, there are businesses that had repaid that had loans of less than $2 million because they just got overly concerned and worried and they didn't want to take the risk of having to prove this. And many of them actually, you know, truly had a need, but they just didn't want to have to wonder if the SBA would think their need was good enough. And unfortunately, nothing has come out so far telling us that those businesses can now go back and ask for the money again. Again, it seems like the answer is no on that side. So that's a problem. But as I say, late on Friday, we ended up getting into this area of a new application. And why do we need an application? Well, a few things were happening. Right. There were a couple of key unanswered questions we had about the forgiveness application. The forgiveness of this debt. One of them was in section 1106B. When they talked about expenses that counted for forgiveness, they told us specifically that costs incurred and payments made were forgivable items. Now, that was a problem. And then they gave us all the list of items that you probably were all kind of familiar with. Right. The payroll costs, the various the specific benefits, the payroll taxes that are state law related. You know, so we have that list, but we had this issue about costs incurred and payments made. And the question becomes, what does that mean? Must a cost be both incurred and paid in order for it to count? Because that's one way to read it, right? They had to be both. So for instance, I had to show that I paid this employee payroll during the 8-week period, and that specific payroll covered time that he or she had performed services during the 8-week period. So I had to make sure I didn't, if I was paying, as I probably would be early on when I got my loan, you know, I'd been paying for a payroll that covered a period outside of the 8-week period. I would be stuck with not being able to count that much of what I spent for. And then secondly, unless I wrote a special payroll on day 56, I would end up having payroll expenses I'd incurred the 8-week period, but that I hadn't paid. But there's a flip side view of that too. You could read it, because the question is, how do you read the and clause here? It could be that both expenses incurred and expenses paid count, and you add the two up. Now, that seemed a little bit, shall we say, generous, because obviously, you know, somebody works for me today and I pay them before the 8 weeks is up. That cost was both incurred. It's going to be in the incurred cost list. It's going to be in the paid cost list. If I get to add up incurred and paid, I'm going to double count. That clearly seems wrong. You know, it seems like that shouldn't work. So that seems way too generous for us to be able to add all that stuff up. But the problem was we needed some way to talk about this. We also had the problem that the SBA had in their interim final rules mentioned and created this thing called a 75% rule. Now, the 75% rule is mentioned in two different contexts in the interim final regulations. It's mentioned at one point as 75% of loan proceeds have to go toward paying payroll costs. But then it's also mentioned in a different context, slightly different context, as saying that at least 75% of the forgiveness amount has to consist of payroll costs. Now, you could just say those two are the same, or let's put it this way. 75% of what is being forgiven has to be payroll costs. Well, that would make sense that 75% of the loan has to be spent on payroll costs because, kind of by definition, it would work in that scenario, at least if they're both in the 8 weeks. But the problem is some banks had worded this and said, well, what it really means is there's a cliff on forgiveness. And by that I mean, if you end up $1 short of 75%, so you borrowed $100,000, but your payroll costs were $74,999, well, sorry guys, you don't get the $74,999 forgiven. You don't get anything forgiven because you didn't spend 75% of the proceeds on payroll costs. And there were banks that put out forgiveness worksheets where that happened. If you didn't have payroll costs equal to 75% of the borrowing, your forgiveness was zero. That was based on reading that IFR and, to another extent, probably more significantly, at least one email that came out of a Small Business Administration office that some people had read, even though it didn't really say that was the rule, it suggested it might be, and that caused the banks to go off and run with these worksheets, at least some of them. But the other way to read it was, well, no, it doesn't matter. What you want to concentrate on is that 75% of the forgiven amount has to be for payroll costs. So if I spend $75,000 during the 8 weeks on payroll costs, the most I can have forgiven is 100 grand. I don't care if I borrowed 200 grand, or 150 grand. 100 grand is the most I got forgiven. Now, obviously, if I only borrowed 75 grand, then 75 is the most I could have forgiven. You can't have more forgiven than you borrowed. But it would just work for that. And if there was any shortfall, you could maybe just pay that back. You could treat that as a loan, in essence, paid over the 2 years. There were various things that might work for that. But we could at least, though, get 1/3 of the payroll costs could be counted in the other category. And then we'd see if we were short anywhere else. So that might work. And then the other catch is a 75% rule. Does that 75% of the proceeds must be spent? Well, does that require by the June 30 date? Does that allow you to catch it up afterwards? But what happens if I don't? Again, we didn't know. We're not going to get a full answer to these questions, but we are going to get some answers today. So let's talk about the new forgiveness applications. It popped out on May the 15th. And what happened that morning was the Small Business Administration's Inspector General was testifying before the House Small Business Committee. And he was asked by Representative Golden specifically about what would happen, what's the status of forgiveness guidance? Because, he said, we got companies here. They're worried it won't be forgiven. They're worried they don't know what they can spend the money on. When are we getting that guidance? Now, this is the Inspector General. The Inspector General in any agency is not involved in writing guidance. They're reviewing what the agency does, and coming back and reporting on that oversight function. They're an oversight group. But he's obviously working, as the Inspector General told us, he was going to be working on the fact they're going to be looking at the forgiveness issues when the SBA deals with that. And he said he was aware that, essentially guidance was going to come out either later that day, turns out that was right, or sometime in the near future that would deal with forgiveness. Now, we don't know this is all of our guidance, but we do know it is the application form. If you remember when we actually got to applying for the loan, we got the application forms first, followed shortly thereafter by interim final regulations and FAQs. So we could very well be seeing those coming out. Okay, what ends up happening? So late in the day, that application was published by the SBA. And as I said, it was after I'd already gotten everything ready to go on the weekly update for the other stuff that had happened, a lot of which, aside from that one change of position on the whether the loan was necessary for somebody with less than $2 million worth of loan proceeds, weren't really major things. They were some, odd ones there, but nothing big. But, it's going to be a week, so I'd go ahead and tell what happened. So I felt this was far more important, so we're doing this one. And the package, you know, consists of the following items. What they put out has the following items in it. And it is the PPP Loan Forgiveness Calculation Form. And you can download this from the SBA and Treasury's website. It's fairly easy to get into. If you go to our website, the story we have on this particular loan forgiveness application, in the footnotes, we have the link to the form. The form is 11 pages long. It has an additional loan forgiveness calculation form. It has Schedule A. PPP Schedule A is going to be important because that's where we actually calculate the costs. So the costs will show up there, the payroll costs, limitations, certain special rules, the reductions. Schedule A is where you're actually going to have the meat of the calculations taking place. So if you want to know what you want to pay a lot of attention to, it's going to be what goes on Schedule A and how we calculate Schedule A, especially when we get to like the reductions for salary and average hourly wages, or we get to the calculations on the full-time equivalent numbers. That's where those calculations go to tell you which employees each one of those things apply to. So that's actually, in many ways, the key form here. We also end up having worksheets to go with Schedule A. These worksheets will not be submitted with Schedule A, but they will tell us, you know, or some of them at least won't be submitted, but they do tell us how to calculate things. So we're going to have a couple of big schedules. We're going to have Table 1 and Table 2, which are crucial for doing these calculations that'll be involved. We have the optional PPP borrower demographic information form. That's a form you can, but are not required to submit. I have no idea why it's there. It looks like it's just information gathering. So bottom line, this is the package you are supposed to, your client or you are supposed to prepare, you know, if you're the borrower, and submit to the Small Business Administration, right? That's how we end up doing it. Now the form itself, first page of the form has information about your loan, right? And the lender, this is submitted to your lender, and it doesn't matter if your lender's even sold the loan. You still submit back to the lender. So if you got your loan from Chase, you submit this document to Chase. That's where it goes. That's who gets it, right? We have this. So we're going to talk about the employees at the time of the application, the employees at the time of forgiveness. That's informational only. You'll actually never really quite use that for anything, but you know, it's informational, so go on there. And we do know that the SBA generally, when they say employees, they do not care if they're full-time or part-time. They're going to count total number of employees, so at those 2 days. If you have an EIDL advance amount and the application number, you'd provide that. That will be factored into. We already said it's going to reduce the PPP loan forgiveness. That's kind of factored in here as well. They want to know your payroll schedule, right? Are you weekly, biweekly, twice a month, or monthly? They're also going to want you to tell them the covered period. Now, that's going to be simple. The first day of that is the day that the money hit your account. The last day of that is 56 days later. Similarly, if you use the alternative payroll covered period, and we'll talk about that here in a second, but if you're using that, you're going to effectively elect it here, right? If you have affiliates and your total loans are more than $2 million, if you and your affiliates have borrowed more than $2 million, check a box. Okay, that's the box you're not going to want to check if you're a small borrower. Because again, when you check that box, you are saying we don't qualify for the safe harbor of the assumption that the loan was necessary. So again, and if you don't remember, the affiliate rules are on the Treasury website. If you're concerned if they're affiliated or not, go look at those rules. That's where the answer is. The application continues on with information. And even though this is the first thing you see, you're going to realize instantly as you look at your payroll costs, you have to go to the PPP Schedule A line 10. PPP Schedule A is where most of this ends up taking place. But this will also be where you'll list your mortgage interest payments, your rent payments, and your utility payments will go on this form. You'll then end up totaling those items, right? Okay. And, you know, add the amounts for these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And 5 is a wage reduction. So if you have a reduction because you didn't maintain salaries or average hourly rates, that reduction comes in here. Line 6 is the total before we look at the FTE reduction. So the first thing to realize here is you apply that reduction for salaries and you apply the reduction for salaries and the reduction for hourly wages going down over the covered period. You apply that before we do the FTE reduction. That's what I think most of us thought we'd end up doing. It's obviously far better news than applying the FTE reduction first and then getting this. This would be at 100%. That'd be the lower percentage. So it makes sense this way, but just understand we now have formal guidance there. You do the FTE reduction quotient. You're going to basically compute how much do you get to keep. And so if your FTEs drop by, you know, whatever, you have a reduction to 10%, you're going to put 0.9 in there and your forgiveness will be 90% of what you've gotten otherwise. If you don't have to do it, you meet a safe harbor. We now have three safe harbors, turns out. Then you put a 1.0 in there. If you just didn't have a reduction, you put a 1.0 in there. That'll be the key. When you get to line 8, you're going to have the modified total. That'll be the actual forgiveness number normally, but we have to test a couple of other limits. First thing is you can't get forgiven more than the loan. So I want to know how much did you borrow? And secondly, you know, what's your payroll cost requirement? So what they're going to do is they're going to take line 1, your payroll cost, and divide by 0.75. What that's actually doing is saying, what number is this 75% of? That will give you the maximum that you can have forgiven based on payroll costs. So remember that theory about add back 1/3? That's really what you're doing here. Dividing by 0.75 is algebraically the equivalent of adding back 1/3 of that number. So we'll get there. Add 1/3 of it on top of it, you get there. The forgiveness amount will be the least of lines 8, 9, and 10. Those three all make sense. 8 is the actual amount you could be forgiven based on costs and the reductions. 9 is how much you borrowed, which obviously you can't be forgiven more than that. And 10 is your actual payroll cost. Now note, interestingly enough, this form seems to ignore interest. You know, it just says interest during that period will still have to be paid. That is in line with what the statute appears to say. Initial interim final guidance indicated that no, you could have the interest forgiven. We'll have to check and see what they actually do, but it looks like they're back to the statute here. So we have that involved, right, as we do it. Now, the other big thing we have here is forgiveness application. The big thing here is there's going to be these certifications that an authorized representative of the borrower makes. Now, don't get taken off by that. Representative does not mean the same thing it does under tax. What we mean by an authorized representative here is almost certainly like an officer of the corporation, if it's a corporation, a manager of the LLC, if it's an LLC, the sole proprietor for sole proprietor, a partner, a general partner, or partner with management authority, if it's a partnership. It's not the CPA. Some people get all worked up. They saw certified. They saw authorized representative. They start combining the taxes rules with what we talk about in taxes, if we say that, and what we talk about in A&A, we say certified, and we somehow said, horrible. CPAs have got to sign off on this. No, nothing in there says that the authorized representative has to be an independent certified public accountant. That's not like, there's a lot of these businesses don't have that anyway. And secondly, nothing in here says the representative cannot be the business owner. My guess is that's exactly what SBA means. But people got freaked out about that. Now, there is one interesting thing here. Remember, and this is like the loan, so we're going to basically initial off on each of these. That's fine. But don't go too quickly off the first one, because there's an interesting last bullet there that the authorized person certifies the dollar amount for which forgiveness is requested. Okay, as all these things, use proper costs, does not include non-payroll costs, except 25%, right? You know, has all these things, fine, includes all the reductions. But the third one is interesting. Tells us it does not exceed 8 weeks worth of the 2019 compensation for an owner employee, self-employed individual, or general partner. Capped at $15,385. Well, $15,385 is the annualized $100,000. That doesn't borrow us, right? But what's interesting is that we do not exceed this 8 weeks worth of compensation. Now, again, remember, we kind of had this for sole proprietors already, because we're saying the maximum they could get count as income replacement was 8/52nd of the 2019 Schedule C. But this appears to expand it to two other categories. First, it expands it to general partners, well, the partners, and we still don't have much guidance at all of what's a payment to a partner and what payments count. I mean, that's still missing. They've always been super late with partners. They are continuing it here. There's nothing else in here that's going to tell you much about what a partner gets. But there's categories. So partners is a new add-on category, and this owner employee. Now, some people are latching on to Section 401c 3 and saying, oh, 401c3, IRC section 401c3, they actually use that term. And I agree that term is used there. But I seriously doubt that that is what the SBA means. There's a couple of reasons. First, that is a single provision inside of the Internal Revenue Code, and these regulations are not being written by the IRS. They're being written by the SBA. Secondly, this form is meant to be filled out by applicants who probably don't just immediately think Internal Revenue Code and this provision. Third, here's the other problem. And there's a lot of problems with that theory. The actual definition of 401c3 tells us it applies only for that section. For section 401c3 does not have any discussion in it of forgivable expenses for a payroll protection program loan. And while we do see it cross-referenced elsewhere, every time it's in the code, we're meant to use that definition. A section specifically cross-references because otherwise it doesn't escape that section. Now we're going to assume that somehow it's escaped that section and gone into a whole different title of the U.S. code. That also seems to be quite of a stretch. And finally, it seems weird because if you decided 401c3 actually is meant to be used for that definition, well, you wouldn't really need to have general partners in there or sole proprietors, because by definition, I guess except maybe for a general partner with less than 10% ownership, but sole proprietor is always in there, they would always be part of the owner employees in those classifications under 401c3. So you would come down with an unnecessary discussion there of self-employed, because you don't need to. They would always come under 401c3. So it's duplicative. It is a bad way to read. Now, I realize this is not a reg, but let's assume at some point we get an IFR that goes along with this. But it's a bad way to read these type of documents and assume that when they give you three categories, that these categories, you know, that some of them are unnecessary to be there because they're totally covered by the others. It would be like saying that, you know, a taxpayer, you know, an individual taxpayer for Form 1040 is a human being, a man, or a woman. Now, I've got news for you. Men, women, generally they fall inside the category of human beings. I mean, normally we would say the way we consider that definition. So there'd be no reason for a definition that says human being, man, or woman. Therefore, I'm going to say when you see this, it's going to come up multiple times. First thing is, when it comes up later, it keeps showing up just as owner and then parenthetically, owner employee, self-employed, and partner, you know, general partner. I think more likely, what could owner employee mean if it doesn't mean, you know, owner, general partner, or sole proprietor? Let's assume like with partner, we're adding to the sole proprietor. Who would be an owner employee? How about an employee? Because again, they got to be an employee. Partners and shareholders, partners and, you know, proprietors aren't employees of their business in question. Okay, we understand that, right? Old English common law rule: they're not employees. So who would be an owner employee? Well, they'd have to be an employee, and if you're an owner, you know, well, how could you own part of the business but still be allowed to be an employee? If you were a shareholder of a corporation that you were employed by, that would make you an owner employee, right? You'd be an owner who's also an employee. If you're a sole proprietor or you're a partner, you can't be an employee. So an owner employee, I think this also may help us when we try to interpret what we mean by the fringes. So owner employee, right? So I'm thinking that this actually applies to corporate shareholders. Whether it is a C corp or an S corp, you're limited to 8/52 of 2019 compensation, which I suspect means, although we have no other additional definition, 8/52 of the W-2 wages that would have counted as compensation when you applied for the loan. So if you took compensation last year of, let's say, you know, $80,000, you take 8/52 of $80,000. If you had compensation of $250,000, well, you're going to take 8/52 of $100,000. You're still capped there. You're going to be capped at $15,385. But that's something that we had never had suggested, that shareholders might be capped. I think they are under these rules. Okay? So basically what we have here is we have a few things for computing, payroll costs, and forgiveness that we're in. And I strongly suggest you do download the write-up that I've got here, because it's got a lot of information, a little bit additional beyond what I put on the website, because I've added a couple of discussions since then, so we're going to have that. So let's talk about covered payroll costs and forgiveness. Well, the interesting part is right away it tells us we're going to have a check. We can select two different covered periods. It is for payroll costs only, but we have two choices. Now, the one we knew about already, it's the 8 weeks that begins on the day the money goes in our bank account. So the money goes in the bank account today. Let's say it went in on, you know, the day you're listening to this. You would have 56 days from today, and we can start counting payroll today. Okay, and we'll talk about what payrolls count, but the 8 week period would count today and go 56 days out. But obviously, a lot of people said, well, that's kind of messy because there's like a, we're in the middle of a payroll period now, and we get to the end of the 8 weeks, we'll be in the middle of a payroll period. And look, we pay biweekly. Why can't we just wait till the next payroll period starts to make this cleaner? That there'll be 8 weeks that clearly are in here for payrolls that are clearly in the mix. And the SBA said, not the IRS, God, even I make that mistake at this point. I do IRS too often. You know what? Makes sense. You can elect an alternative payroll covered period. So let's say the money went in today. If your next payroll starts in 3 days, your next payroll period starts in 3 days, then you can wait and not start the 8 week period for payroll only. We'll discover this will not apply for like your rents, utilities, everything out. They're going to go back to the day the money dropped in. But for the payroll purposes, you can start that as of that later payroll period, so long as you are paying at least biweekly. Yeah, it is a requirement that you must have a biweekly payroll involved. So if you're not paying biweekly, we've got an issue here. So if, for instance, let's say you pay semi-monthly or monthly, then you've got to use the standard covered period. Now, there are specific instructions about how to deal with this, right? Okay, line one numbers are total payroll costs for the covered period. That's on your application. We will discover on Schedule A, right? Okay, we do not include the employee owner, self-employed, or a partner. We're not going to be involved in that. We then add in specific business mortgage interest, business rent or lease payments, and business utility payments. Those are all part of that application form. Now again, the payroll costs are going to come in from Schedule A. And you're going to find out that we're going to take the owner out for, and I should say, the slide's actually slightly wrong here. We'll take the owner out, then add them back in later, but there's going to be two different tables that will not include the owner. The owner will come at the end, and we may have to attach a separate schedule if we have more than one owner. So if we have more than one owner, we have to attach a separate schedule. So that gets a little more interesting along those lines. Okay, now what ends up happening here is we talk about the issue of payroll costs. And one key issue for payroll costs that's really nice here is we have some really interesting issues here about whether a cost is paid or incurred, right? We had that problem. What does paid incurred mean? Well, if you look in the definition of payroll costs, it'll talk first about using it in the covered period. Okay, that makes sense. But then it goes on and discusses the paid and incurred issue. And it's not the super taxpayer-friendly interpretation that we discussed briefly at the beginning, but it's very much closer to that than anything else. Okay? You get to count as your payroll cost for the 8 week period any costs you paid during that period. So, and it says nothing about the cost being incurred. So, if you had, let's say you got the money today, Monday, you are going to pay the payroll. Your payroll period started on Saturday. Let's say you start your week on Saturday. So you got the money today, but you actually issue the payroll checks on Monday. You're going to be able to count on Monday that entire payroll, all of which was outside the covered period. The entire payroll outside the covered period will count. Why? Because it's inside the 56-day period. Now, if you decide to wait till your next payroll period starts, then yeah, that's probably not going to work. That, you know, that check may fall outside. But note, most of us don't pay the paycheck on the exact last day of the payroll period, right? We rather pay the paycheck the next, like, you know, 2 or 3 days later, because we need to get the hours in and calculate payroll and get it run. So bottom line, you know, you're going to find that in a lot of cases, you're going to pick up an extra payroll. If you do the alternative payroll period and you're biweekly, you're going to pick up five payrolls in most cases. And the law says, okay, that's okay, because the other side would say, yeah, but that last payroll is not going to be paid till after the 56 days are over. Got that covered too. If the costs were incurred during the 56-day period and those payroll costs are paid on the next upcoming payroll check, that also counts toward forgiveness. So like I said, I should be able to jam in if I'm a biweekly payroll. I usually pay like a couple of days after the payroll period ends. I should be able to fit in five payrolls inside of my 8-week period. Five entire payrolls. This is going to make it a whole lot easier to meet the 75% test. Just way easier to meet it, right? Because you're picking up a whole additional payroll. You're not just picking up 4 weeks. You're not just picking up 8 weeks. You're actually probably picking up 10 weeks worth of work. So you're going to have 10 weeks worth of payroll in there. Now, if you don't do the alternative calculation, then you're just going to prorate, you know, at the beginning, you'll include all everything coming in, then prorate at the end. So in a lot of cases, I think, especially for biweekly payrolls, you're going to discover you're going to get the best, most bang for the buck by using the alternative period. That's going to help you the most by going down that path. Okay. Now, so we talked about that, paying with the payroll cost by the first billing date. Oh, and also, we're going to find out these same rules will carry over to non-payroll costs. So like your utilities. Most likely, your utility period, billing period doesn't end on this end of 56 days, and you don't pay it that same day. But you actually can do the same thing there. So let's say my 8-week period ends on June the 16th, and I have a monthly, you know, my actual utility bill runs from June 1st to June 30, and I pay that bill sometime in July. When I get the bill in July, I can figure out what my costs were through June 16th, and that much will be considered part of my cost as long as I pay it on time on the next bill. That's interesting. Now, they do tell us we cannot count the same cost twice. That also is why it's not quite too good to be true. You know, you don't get to count cost twice, and it's not like you don't have to ever pay it. You have to pay it. You have to pay it relatively quickly after the end of the period. But if you do that, you've got a lot more costs in here than you might have expected, because like for utilities, you're probably going to get the whole of two periods and a portion. You're going to get the whole of 1 month and a portion, you know, you probably get a whole of, you know, let's say you get a whole of 2 months and a portion of another. Same thing's going to be for like transportation expenses, assuming those are billed that way. But you're going to talk about like phone bills, ISP bills, all those things. You'll get two whole months most likely and a portion of another. So this seems like it's going to work well for taxpayers. I mean, that, you know, work well for borrowers, I should say. Should be a good run. Payroll for owners, employees, we cannot exceed 8 works with the 2019 guidance. And that appears to be what we're saying here. And again, we don't know what owner employees are. We don't have a definition of that. But I think we have to be concerned that definitely are shareholders of corporations. Seems to me be by far the most plausible explanation for owner employees. I guess LLC members make, or LLC, you know, LLC managers maybe, because maybe they don't know if the IRS is correct that if your LLC elects to be a partnership, you can't treat the members or the managers as employees. May or may not be right there, because they go back to English common law and partnerships, and these aren't really legally partnerships. So, but maybe they're saying, well, if you're worried about that, since it's in tax law, we're going to accept this. But you're still going to be considered owner employee. So whatever, you're stuck with that. Other big changes we got in here on the guidance. We also have the other eligible costs. We talked about the covered mortgage cost. Covered mortgage costs include both real and personal property. That we knew about. We also would ask to be the interest, right? You can't prepay interest. So that clearly does not work. That's not allowed. We also talked about rents. And covered rent obligations, it does tell us it's both real and personal property. Some people are very concerned that only rents on the building could count. No, if you are, let's say, like you're a trucking company and you're leasing a lot of trucks, all of those truck leases counts. And oh, by the way, they get out, yeah, we're doing it as capital leases. And I'm saying nothing to me suggests the SBA is going to look at anything except the legal status of the lease. Not going to worry about what tax or GAAP says about the lease. and gap, whether it's a capital lease or a financing lease, depending on which lease standard you're under at the instant. I don't think that's going to matter for this. I think the lease payments will count 100%. If you're paying on contract for something, so you have a contract that's secured by the truck, then you're only going to get the interest. But if it's lease, you'll get everything. I think that's pretty clear. Okay. And covered utility payments, electricity, gas, water, transportation, telephone, or internet access. They list all those things on the application that comes straight from the law. Again, the only good thing we had about transportation came in that guidance that they gave us for self-employed. And that's where he said, like, gas for the car. So I suppose if you'd been charging gas, you still got a bank. You still got one of those gas, you know, those, we talk about, you know, the oil company's credit cards for buying gas at their stations, and you pay that monthly. Well, if you're still doing it that way, or whoever's charging you for it, then yeah, fuel would work that way. And you can still get that in pretty easily, right? If you're one of those who pays at the pump all the time because you just don't want to mess with one more bill, which actually paid this time. Payroll costs must make up 75% of the forgiven debt. That is very clear under these standards, right? And there's no 75% payroll cost cliff rule. Nothing in this application makes your receipt of forgiveness contingent on spending 75% of the proceeds on payroll. Now, I guess we could say maybe they'll impose that outside somewhere, but it would seem like kind of obvious that if that was there, you would have had an extra line to compare to and said, oh, by the way, you know, the maximum forgiveness under that last calculation for 75%, set this number to zero if at least 75% of the proceeds weren't used for payroll. So, yeah, they skipped that. I think they skipped it intentionally. Now, the next thing we go to is that Schedule A, right? Schedule A talks about enter cash compensation, right? Enter the average FTE and enter the salaries and wage reduction, right? So we end up having those things, right? So we'll talk about this worksheet for Table 1 and Table 2. We'll talk about who's in Table 1, who's in Table 2. Those tables, which are significant, they are in the actual document, and we reproduce them in the PDF. If you download that, you'll be able to see them there too. Those tables cover two classes of employees other than the owner, employee, self-employed, and partner. Okay, they're left off of this. But basically, Table 1 is going to cover one set of employees. Table 2 will cover another. Okay. Now, here we go. How we're going to end up with this form. Table 1 will deal with any employees that are paid $100,000 or less, I guess the way to phrase it, right? Annualized on payrolls. So basically, anybody who had a payroll last year, and this is those from last year, had a payroll last year, any payroll where their annualized pay would have been more than 100 grand. And it is weirdly on a payroll by payroll test. So it doesn't mean they had to be over 100 grand, just they got a payroll where, you know, we were paying them, let's say, you know, we're going to pay them there on the payroll. That payroll takes them over, like it was a weekly payroll, and you gave them a bonus, and they got a check for $3,000. Well, $3,000 annualized is going to be more than $100,000, so they'd be on Table 2, right? This is Table 1. Why Table 1 versus Table 2? It becomes obvious when we talk about the different limitations, why we have a Table 1 and a Table 2 set. But Table 1 is going to have less than $100,000 annualized on payroll. Table 2 is going to be those, because this one's going to apply the FTE reduction, full-time employee reduction, equivalent, full-time equivalent, I say not full-time employee, full-time equivalent, make sure I get that right, as well as the salary and hourly wage reduction. Both reductions apply to Table 1. Table 2 is going to be your non-owner employees, non-self-employed, non-partners, who had more than $100,000 annualized at some point on 2019. They still participate in that, be considered in the FTE and full-time equivalent reduction, but they are not part of the salary wage hour reduction. So they don't come into that category. After you list those guys, then we're going to list, as you see here, the compensation to owners, okay? So what we get here is line one, line two. Then we start getting these, basically the amounts that are paid for health insurance, retirement plans, and payroll taxes that are state or local, the add for owners, and that's going to get us our total payroll cost at the end of the day. So the key aspect here is we're going to get everybody's payroll. So bottom line, we know the basics of this, right? Everybody's payroll that we paid, that are paid or occur in the 8-week period, subject to that $15,385 cap, is listed. So nobody goes over that limit, right? We end up with that. We end up with the self-employed limit is there, right? And again, can't go over $15,385. Then we add in our fringe benefits, okay? And that's our total payroll costs. Now, we may have reductions. So total payroll costs doesn't consider reductions yet. Why not? Because remember, those reductions went on the main application form. So this just accumulates our costs. Having gotten our costs, we have to now do the calculation of the possible reductions. Again, two categories of reductions, full-time equivalents, and we have the reductions for the reduction in salary or hourly wages, okay, that reduction. So let's talk about how this works, right, as we get into it. The non-cash compensation items were health plans, retirement plans, payroll taxes. I think the discussions in the manual, I think owner employees, that is shareholders, are going to still get that. I think the fact they keep referring to amounts paid for employees is significant. If you take owner employee, if you take employee to be significant there, to mean real employees, then it would appear you'd get these particular expenses here, because again, we're talking about paid for employees. If you're going down that 401c3 line, then I think you're in trouble with these expenses because you're kind of ignoring employees, and now I think it's a little tougher bringing these in, but we'll get there, how we go down that route. It's not okay for self-employed or partners. It's limited to employees. So self-employed partners are not employees legally. So apparently we don't get to count those for those people, right? Compensation for owners. If you have owner's compensation, right, which you probably do. Remember that last line, line 9? If you got that last line 9, compensation for owners, then remember on the compensation for owners line, you're going to have to include for compensation for owners, a list of all the owners if there's more than one. If there's only one, presumably we'll know who that is. If there's more than one, you got to give me details on every owner that's included in that list, because there, and the main reason is, to be totally honest, because it's only compensation there, is going to be they want to know that none of the owners went over $15,385. So bottom line, if that number is more than $15,385, there better be a plain paper schedule listing information about the owners, because that number cannot go above $15,385 if there's only one owner. And I suspect that's how they're going to look at that. If that number is above $15,385, there better be a schedule attached, right? We need that separate table prepared for the owners if you do that. We get total payroll cost forgiveness applications not yet subject to reduction. Again, the reductions coming here will then go on the actual application form. So we're going to talk about the reduction. We need to compute FTE and the salary hourly wage reductions. Now, again, salary hourly wage reductions only applies to Table 1. Individuals that were not paid above $100,000 annualized on any pay period. So that's for that category. There we have to worry about whether they had a salary or hourly wage reduction. FTE applies to everybody except owner employees, partners, and the self-employed, right? Everybody else is in that category, right? That's going to be crucial when we get down to it. And as we told you before, you're first going to apply the salary and wage reduction, right, on that. So we're going to have that number first. That's the first one. Then we're going to take the FTE percentage reductions if those are in play, right? We do those. And we talked about who they applied to, that I already mentioned to you, who's going to be in that mix and who gets stuck. So we talk about these particular reductions in this case. So Table 1 and Table 2's definitions, right? We had that. Cash compensation is put on there, right? Next up, they're going to want to have the average FTE for each employee. So what you're going to put for each employee is the average hourly work they perform. Right, the average hourly work during the periods in question. And there are a ton of periods you're going to have to work with here to get average numbers. So you got to keep an eye. You're going to be getting weekly payroll information from all over the place through the FTEs. But what the FTE rules tell us is that, number one, no more than, it's going to be a 40-hour test. This is actually something I want to comment on for a second here, because, and I want to get back to that owner, employee, and people going to 401c3. We are tax people. We tend to think in terms of tax rules. A lot of CPAs I talked to were sure that 30 hours was going to be full-time equivalent. Why were they so sure? They would not have been so sure about 30 hours being a full-time equivalent in 2007 or 8. But why did they suddenly become sure that was it? They became sure that was it because the Affordable Care Act is the place they remember seeing full-time equivalent, and the ACA used a 30-hour test. Now, I was using it for a totally different reason, but I saw a lot of CPAs go down the 30-hour route. I never thought the 30-hour route was plausible. First thing is, most small businesses have no clue what it is because you have to be an Apple large business to have ever even worried about that test. And frankly, if you're a really big business, you never worried about that test either. The only time it mattered for the ACA, because that was just to see if you had to, if you were going to be subject to the payment for not offering your employees insurance. And if you're Walmart, you knew you cleared 50 FTEs. So you weren't even going to worry about ever worrying about what the definition of FTE was, because whatever it is, we got more than 50 of them. And if you were a small veterinary clinic that had, you know, the doctor and two assistants, you know, it didn't matter how you defined FTEs, you weren't going to have more than 50 of them. So really, the only people that really knew that definition were people who were sitting right on the edge of 50 FTEs, and which is going to be not going to be the vast majority of businesses, either really big or really small. Right? We're going to have just this odd category. You guys know who you are. You know how that works, but nobody else does. Now, CPAs who cite the heck out of the Affordable Care Act, of course, we all know what that thing works and how it works and the computations. So we went straight to that. Again, that was a bias we had that we got to be very aware of. Don't use tax law to fill in things, because if you do that, somebody coming from another category is going to fill in their law. This is a banking law. Okay? It's going to be a banking issue. There have been FTEs used before in SBA, and it has been inconsistent guidance in the past. But in this case, very simple. 40 hours is an FTE, right? Also, no employee can make up more than one FTE. So if you have somebody who worked 50 hours during the week, that's still only one FTE. It's not going to be, you know, an additional 1-point-something FTEs, only 1.0, right? And when you do the average, you're going to average your FTEs. You're going to put your FTEs, your hours for everybody. And you're going to take that average down to 0.1 each week, so only to the nearest tenth. And then you're going to average the weeks and take that to the nearest tenth. Okay, so everything goes to the nearest tenth in doing these computations. So it's a bit of fudge. And there's a simplifying assumption if you want to use it. You can just say, when I'm counting FTEs, and apparently we do use this for everything if we do it, but anybody that works 40 hours or more during a week is 1, and everybody else is 0.5. I don't care if they work 2 hours or 39 hours, they're 0.5. So if you just want to do it that way, you can do it that way, right? Only worry about people that work 40 or more. Everybody else is 0.5, regardless of how many hours they worked. So that's an option. You don't have to use. You can use the real numbers, but you use the option. Otherwise, you're going to need to have hourly by employee, limit each employee to 40, and then add up the hours and divide by 40 and go to the nearest tenth. Okay, that's how you're going to do it. Then take every week involved in the period, right, and average those hours. Every week, or apparently portion of a week in that period, and average them over that hours. So, for instance, I talk about FTEs on a specific date, which we do. We talk about FTEs on February 15th. That appears to be the pay period that included February 15th, and the average FTE hours for that pay period will be your February 15th number. The same thing about June 30. You'll take the pay period that includes June 30, get your average FTEs for that week, and that appears to be your June 30 FTE number. Both of those numbers become important in different contexts. So we're in that mix. Sometimes it is a time, sometimes it's a number of weeks, sometimes it is just a single point in time. Okay? The FTE calculation is done. We said average the weekly FTE for the reference period. Remember, there are three potential reference periods, depending upon whether you are considered to be a there are three possibles if you're seasonal, and actually one is actually there's almost not infinite but pretty large number of possibles if you're seasonal, but there are three categories. So your reference period can be February 15, 2019 to June 30, 2019. So I got to go back and dig up the payroll for that and get your hours for every pay period that is in that time period that is either wholly or partially in there. Add up. Again, get the average FTE for each of those weeks, add up those averages, and again, always go to 1/10 when doing so. You then compare that to the same calculation on the period for the first 2 months of this year. And if you're a seasonal employer, then you also have the third option, which is using any 12-week period between May 1st of 2019, 12 consecutive week period, and September 15th of 2019. Now, it has to begin and end within that period, So you can't pick, apparently, September 15th of 19 and go 12 weeks out from that. Rather, you got to back up the 12 weeks. But you could use any period that works in there that's within, fully contained within that period. You go ahead and use that as your test period for reference. So your reference period is important because we're going to compare that. The reference period is what we compare to your FTEs during the covered period, whichever period you picked as your covered period. So we're going to take that calculation, that average, and we're going to take the reference period, right? Then we're going to take, right, the actual period, right? Total average FTE, that's going to be lines 2 and 5 from the worksheet. Now, the worksheet talks about your average FTEs. Those are from Table 1 and Table 2. Then we're going to compute our average FTEs for Table 1 employees and Table 2 employees, and then we're going to take that average and add that together, add those two averages together. And obviously, if the average FTE computed in that fashion during the covered period, whichever one it is less than the average during the reference period, then you have a preliminary reduction. So you're going to hope that line 12 is equal to or greater than line 11. If it is less, then you compute the ratio, right? And if that works out to be 0.87, then you have 0.87. That means you're only going to get 87% of the amount that you would otherwise qualify for as your payroll costs, your payroll and other qualified costs. So you're going to reduce that to 87% of what you would have otherwise qualified for. So that's a problem unless we can meet one of the safe harbors. Now, Table 1 and Table 2 are reproduced on the screen for you right now. And like I said, Table 1, we list each employee who's covered by that. We give an identifier for the employee, right? Whatever type of identifier you've got. Then we give their total compensation capped at $15,385 for the period. We figure out their FTE for that employee for the period. Okay? We're going to list that for everyone. And we'll do the salary and hourly wage projection we're talking about here just shortly. We'll do that for these Table 1 employees as well. For Table 2 employees, you're again going to go back. And for each employee, this calculation is done for each employee. Each employee, I get their FTE, you know, well, how much FTE for each week, limiting to one for every week. So that's also quirky. They work extra hours in, let's say they work 50 hours this week, and then they work 30 next. Well, they're going to have 1.0 the first week and less than 1.0 the second. And you have to get their average FTE. So that's another quirk, right? So yeah, you need to have them work 40 hours every week, right, if they're going to be a full-time. Want to make sure they get 40 somehow. Now, I would assume that would count in the leave time you paid them for, but you want to get them to 40 for every week, right? So we get 1.0 for that person all the way. Their average is 1.0. We do that for every employee in Table 1. We're going to do the same thing for every employee in Table 2. Then we're going to take those average FTEs, the employee average FTEs. We're going to add those up in each of the two tables. We're going to average that, right? Total that up, divide by number of employees, go to the nearest tenth. That'll give us our total for Table 1, average FTEs, Table 1, average FTE for the covered period, Table 2. Then add those two up, and they go onto that worksheet, and hopefully they're greater than what we have for our FTEs computed. And it does definitely appear that we can leave the owner employees and the partner and the sole proprietor out of the calculation. Right, it tells you to do it just like you do for the tables. So yes, you can keep out of that denominator, that number too, because that's kind of your problem. We just do that comparison. Okay, let's assume we got a problem, right? We do. We have a problem here, right? Our forgiveness amount, right? It didn't quite work. So our reduction between the reference period and the covered period, and we add up those two, we're not, you know, that second number is less than the first. We have to do our percentage. That's going to reduce by this percentage, but we can get relief. We have three ways to get out of this, one of which was added by the form. How's that for quirky? Okay, so let's talk about our relief items. Okay, well, first thing is, if an employee refused employment, right, we offered to bring them back on. They said, I'm making more on unemployment. I'm not taking your offer of a job. So we document, we gave them written, and we document that they refused us. That employee comes out of the FTE calculations on both ends. Right, we take them out of the first calculation and we take them out of the second. So that one doesn't count. We throw that FTE out the window, right? That one doesn't matter unless we replace that person. Now, if we replace that person, they're not going to let you count the replacement and ignore the guy that used to be there. So if you replace them, you know, you threw that guy out, but hey, I got to still spend this payroll money. I hired somebody to replace them. Then you don't get to use this particular rule. Other interesting part about this rule we'll talk about is when we look about what we send on to the SBA, we're not going to send this proof that somebody turned us down on. It's interesting that we don't have to do that. Okay. If you have an FTE reduction safe harbor, there is a worksheet to do it. And what they tell you to do on the worksheet for the FTE reduction safe harbor, right? They have a worksheet, and they have there a five-step worksheet to walk through for this particular reduction. Those five steps, you know, they're going to tell us to essentially first enter the borrowers, right? Enter the borrowers' total FTE between February 15th, 2020 and April 26th, 2020. Now you're going to say, wait, where'd that period come from? That doesn't bear any relationship to anything. I know it doesn't. Don't worry. This calculation bears no relationship, and you basically cannot use almost any of the work you've done before for FTE if you're into this safe harbor. So go back, do the calculations for February 15th, April 26th, do those pay periods. You've not done this yet, so go do it, right? We're going to do that, right? Then we're going to take our pay period that included February 15th, 2020. Well, we kind of had to get that through the first calculation. I'm going to have that number. Put that number in. Now, here's the catch. If the FTEs at February 15th are less than that average FTE from February 15th to April 26th, you're done. You can't meet the safe harbor. Well, I mean, I can't meet the safe harbor, right? You know, I had fewer in February. I hired people extra. Why can't I meet the safe harbor by April 26th? I hired extra people. Just because you can't. There's no rhyme or reason here. You cannot do it. You have to have reduced since February 15th. So you mean I'm being given a benefit for reducing? Yeah, kind of. Yeah, you had to get rid of them by April 26th and come down. But if you came down in that period from what you had that payroll on February 15th, then you might do this, right? Okay. Now, if that's true, now you take the payroll period that includes June 30 of 2020. If that number is greater than your February 15th, is greater than or equal to the February 15th FTEs, then you meet the safe harbor, put 1.0, get rid of your reduction, you're done. Why? Because that's how the law is written. You want an explanation for why? Why? Senator Rubio has been tweeting a lot. You could ask him. But I have no idea why they decided to use these crazy periods and why you have this crazy rule and why, you know, if you didn't get rid of people between February 15th and April 26th, or basically get rid of enough to drop your average below what you had February 15th, why you can't get this benefit, don't ask me. You just can't. Okay? I told you, it's crazy. Now, there are a couple of other ways. There is one other way to get a reduction. If you take a look on the application form, remember, when we went back to the original application form, take a look at that, and we get to the FTE reduction section on the application form. It has an interesting line. It says, if you have not reduced the number of employees or the average paid hours of your employees between January 1st, 2020 and the end of the covered period, check here, skip the lines, put 1.0 in. January 1st? That's not any of these periods. I know it's not. But if you have not reduced in that period, so here's the quirk. I mean, in theory, this could, in odd circumstances, bail you out. I'm certain they did it just for simplicity. You know, like you've got somebody like, let's say we're taking my particular CPA firm. You know, everybody there is full-time. They were there January 1st. They're there today. They're still full-time. They're, in essence, don't worry about this computation for FTE reduction. It's like, no, we're just going to let you skip it. Simplify it. If there's been no reductions, we're fine. But, you know, there still could be a problem because here's where it comes. What if you know, it's like some weird ways that this could come back to haunt you. It's just, you know, like what happens if you actually increased employees from January 1st until February 15th, but then after that you drop back to what you had in January. Well, in theory, you could fail all the other tests. Especially if the January 1st to February 29th was your lowest FTE number, right? you know, was one he had to use. You could still potentially have a problem with that and maybe not be able to pass the other test, but you might actually pass this one. If the January 1st number is less than your safe harbor, but you've still got the January 1st number and you never went below that number, then apparently we get the safe harbor. This safe harbor is not in the law. The other thing, so as I said, FTE applies both Table 1, Table 2. The other key issue here is only applicable to Table 1. You notice Table 2 is kind of like chopped off, right? You know, you see that. It's like Table 1, there's like an extra column. The extra column is there because the salary and hourly wage reduction only applies to employees who had no payroll in 2019, which annualized above 100 grand. And so you can't be an owner employee, a partner, right? A partner or a self-employed person. You cannot have had any payroll in 2019 that went above 100 grand. If both of those are true, then we have to worry about whether you've had a salary or hourly wage reduction. And this also is done a little differently. Right. And what you have to realize when you do this, this is, again, an employee by employee calculation. So for each employee in Table 1, you have got to do this calculation. Right. Only for Table 1 employees. Right. First thing you have to do, and where you're going to find this, and you really want to go get your documentation. You got to get the information for the actual, you know, in the PDF, because here's what you have to do. They have in that, in the, on the form, on the 11 pages, they have here the steps. There is a three-step calculation, actually kind of was, yeah, three-step calculation to do this. So the first thing you have to do is you have to enter, you have to go with the average annual salary or hourly wage during the covered period or the alternative payroll period, right? So we're going to have to do, what you got to do is you got to, for every payroll, come up with an average annualized compensation for that employee if they're salaried, or the average hourly wage we paid them. Notice we're not worried about how much we paid them. We're just worried about the hourly rate we paid them, which is interesting. Okay. Then we have to average those for each one, right? Okay. So compute that average. Okay. Right. So the average annual salary, average annual wage. And what you're going to do is then you're going to compute an average annual wage. The average annual wage you're going to compute will be essentially that hourly salary times 40, that wage, that, let's say, that annual wage, that particular wage rate, times the hours, times the weeks in the year. So again, we take both of them up to a full year calculation, right? We try to see what that's going to be. Next, we do for the covered period, we've already done that. You also have to do it for January 1st, 2020 to March 31st, 2020. Because that's going to be involved. And then we're going to check and see if that ratio is more than 0.75, then there's no reduction. You can reduce it, but it can't be less than 0.75. Otherwise, we have to worry about the safe harbor. So now we're looking for each employee. Did we reduce there? Do they have a reduction? So we're going to compute for each employee this reduction, right? Okay. Then we're going to go ahead and we're going to compute the annual salary again, average annual salary, and the annual wage, which is as of 215 to 426. And again, if the second number is greater than or equal to the first, then the reduction applies. We can't get out. Otherwise, we go back to our June 30 payroll and do the same crazy thing. Now, again, what we're going to do is we're going to compute a fake annualized number. Okay. If that goes below 0.75, we've done it. Then we have to go back for the employee. And what we have to do, if you have an employee who is a salary wage reduction and we have below 0.75 reduction in their wages, right? You have to enter the average numbers of hours they work per week between January 1st and March 31st of 2020. You have to multiply that amount entered, that number, those average hours, right? By basically that wage rate. So, you know, let's say they worked on average 20 hours a week. And we say that on average they were short, you know, whatever they were short, their hourly wage. We multiply that up. We take that times 8. And that's our shortfall that we have to put in for that employee. So let's say they were, you know, they were short $1 an hour. They worked 20 hours that week. That'd be a $20 reduction for that week, right? We do those reductions for them because they weren't at 0.75. So we do their average wage. And then we multiply that times 8. So that's 160. So we had an average reduction for them of 20, you know, let's say the 20 hours. So their wage reduction was average 20 out, was on average on 20 hours, so a dollar, $20. Multiply that times 8, there's your 160. Is this confusing? Oh, heck yeah. You've got to go to the worksheet to do it. Now, if it's salary, it's a little bit easier because there we just take their annualized salaries, right? And that's a simple math. If it drops more than 0.75, whatever that drop is, that's what you add in. And so, again, for these employees, less than 100,000, not owner employees, not partners, not self-employed, add up their numbers. That is your reduction that goes on page 1. And again, the crazy other dates we use for seeing if they restored them. Again, ask Congress why they use those dates. I have no clue why they did it, right? That's it, right? That's how we do it. We have the reduction compensation. We talked about those issues, right? And expand it up. So we do that. Now, the other catch is, interesting aside, what do we have to provide? The end of the document tells you the things you're going to provide to the bank, right? So to verify payroll, they're going to want you to have the bank account statements or third-party payroll service reports documenting the amount of cash compensation paid to employees, the tax forms or third-party payroll service provided forms, such as the Form 941 and the state quarterly and individual employee tax reporting and unemployment insurance reporting, or that are or will be reported to the states, and then payment receipts, canceled checks, account statements that document the amounts were actually paid. For the FTE calculations, you're going to have to documentation showing the average number of FTE employees on payroll per month employed by the borrower between February 15th and June 30, average number of FTE employees on payroll per month employed January 1st and February 29th, or finally, in the case of a seasonal employer, those average, you got to compute your covered period, whatever period you used, and you got to be the same, and then you got to verify the existence of obligations or services performed prior to February 15th. So you got to show that you had utilities from this company as of that date, the account was there as of that date, your ISP was there as of that date, February 15th, etc., and documentations of the amounts paid in that case. Now, the other things you have to provide, you got to have documentation supporting the listing of each individual on Schedule 1, but you don't have to provide, you just have to have it. Same thing for Table 2. Documentation on job offers, and documentation supporting the FTE reduction of safe harbors. They ought to be available for on request to the SBA or its representative, which will be the lender, most likely, who might ask for it. Now, this is far more than we had before, but doesn't answer everything. There are still some key obvious missing answers. We need information on, is owner, employee, self-employed, and partner really three categories I mentioned here? Are the 401c3 people right? If they are, what does that mean, right? That could be there. Specific partners related issues, especially how guaranteed payments are involved. And do Cheryl's employees have the same fringe benefits limits as sole proprietors? You could read them as having the limits. That 15,385 is a flat-out limit period for all payroll costs, not just cash compensation for them. So, yeah, it's all a little weird. And partners, as always, no guidance on how partners work. That's still the screwball part of all of this, right? So you're going to have to watch for more interim final rules and FAQ updates from the SBA or Treasury. That's all I can tell you for sure about this. We don't know what else is happening. Now, we are further along on the program. We're having to deal with it. And if you want to take a little break right now and just take some time, try to figure out how all this goes together. Because I've done a whole lot of one-hour webinars. You guys probably have been in one-hour webinars, two-hour webinars. It's been a rush. It's been a rush because there's been tons of stuff to cover. No time really to go detailed questions. We were just like, go, go, go. We are doing full eight-hour sessions, and we continue. We've already done two of them. We're going to do, at this point, we have scheduled three more. Two of them coming up here shortly. One of which is very short, depending on when you listen to this. Right. For the Idaho Society of CPAs, there is a webcast on May 19th and 20th coming up. So again, you have to listen to this on Monday, I guess, and sign up. We will go over what I just mentioned here today. And so if you have questions on that, that'd be a great place to get online. And we'll talk about them some more about what matters. And maybe more guidance. Who knows? It'll be, again, COVID-19 tax law changes. 8-hour session broken into 2 4-hour morning sessions. The idea of that was to give you time to go back, do other work you need to do, talk with clients, try to maybe, you know, take care of whatever the crisis is. Because, by the way, you do realize you guys are all supposed to know all about this application first thing Monday morning, right? You're supposed to know how this works. Right. The next week, I'll be doing a session for the Washington State Society of CPAs. When I say Washington State Society, somebody doesn't think I'm doing it for the DC Society. No, Washington, State of Washington Society of CPAs. It'll be a standard 8-hour session on May the 27th. Again, members of each of those societies can qualify for discounts. Non-members have to pay the full cost to go to those sessions. Both of them will be webcast, so yes, you do not have to be in. In fact, they're going to be, as I said, neither of the societies are doing live sessions, you know, as I know at this point at their location at the moment. So we're not being able to be live regardless, so it will be online. One thing I will suggest before you do an online session, go to fast.com, which is run by Netflix, and just look at your upload and download speeds. Download speeds is your big problem. If you're seeing download speeds that are trickling down to very low numbers in the single digits, you're probably going to have trouble on the webcast. And you may discover that everybody in your house is running 4K video on Netflix. That could be a problem. But you want to kind of double check that. And yes, and all these societies tend to give you a test link that you can verify you won't have problems. Both of the sessions you're going to be doing are using Adobe Connect. Both of them should give you the test link to Adobe Connect. Do the test link. Make sure there's no obvious problem with your setup right then. Again, sometimes it's just going to be a problem you're going to have that day because there's a quirk with your ISP. There's a quirk with your direct connection to Adobe, their servers. But kind of double check that. It really does help. And the other strong suggestion, try to log in kind of early. I realize usually there may just be music or something playing. Not much there. But if you get in and you can't get in, it's helpful to know that a half hour ahead of time because the tech support lines get overburdened right at the start of the session. If you can call in and tell somebody, look, I'm not being able to connect. I can't see anything on my screen. You know, I don't see what I should see. That actually helps. You know, if you get in there, you see what you should see. Things come up. You'll know right away if there's a problem. And the good part about that is you can actually get your tech support before all the people that wait to the last second to log in are suddenly having connection problems. And if you wait to the last second, odds of having connection problems are always found are way higher. Whenever I check in a half hour early, I never have problems, which is, I think the computers just rig it that way. So anyway, be sure you try to check in early. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. We're going to do our regular updates, be it online, www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If we do get a new IFR or new FAQs related to the forgiveness calculation, that's where I'm going to write the stuff up first, so that's where you'll see it. We are going to do the weekly updates, and again, I'll be doing the regular style update again next week. What I'm probably going to end up having to do is take what I had this week and add it to next week and just do a big one for that, so we'll see what's coming up. If you want to follow me on Twitter, at Ed Zollers, we've actually had quite a bit of discussion on Twitter this weekend regarding these loans because everybody's kind of trying to get ready for Monday morning and the client's asking all the questions. Also, I do go online. If you're a member of the Connect sites for the Arizona, New Jersey, Illinois, or Minnesota Society of CPAs, get the right groups on there. I should find you there looking at those things. I do try to monitor those sites. And by the way, Illinois is the third state that we're going to be doing a session on. We're going to do a session in June for the Illinois Society Illinois CPAs related specifically to, these changes with COVID-19 and the PPP loans and all that other stuff. So that's coming up later in June if you're in Illinois and you've got it. We also do follow me on on Tax Pros on Reddit /r/TaxPros. I do post some items there every so often. I also follow the Cal CPA discussion groups at Tax Talk. So, and that's open to any CPA across the country. If you want to be on that site, you can do it. And otherwise, keep your eyes open. We are almost certainly going to have more guidance. We're almost certainly the banks are going to start reacting to this and sending emails to their clients. And so you're probably going to get questions on those. So you want to make sure if you've not downloaded the 11-page application form and information, do that. You really should read that and have it, so at least you're comfortable talking about it come Monday because clients are going to call. The questions are coming. And we'll be back here next week to talk to you more about current federal tax developments.